Blenders, and welcome to episode number 101 of Real Blend, a podcast that now has its very own intro music, as you guys have heard. And only one person on social media pointed out that we had music. They were like, oh, is this part of the live show for 100? No, it's not. It's official. We have it now. I've been begging Gabe for it forever, and we finally have intro music. Episode highlights. We are going to talk about the Oscar nominations and all of the fallout from what the Academy decided to go to. We're going to share some Critics' Choice Awards stories. And then later on, we're playing a blend game that I'm already going to predict is going to be one of my favorite of all time. We're playing hashtag scene blend, and we're going to discuss some of our favorite scenes. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing director here at Cinema Blend. And as always, I am joined by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jakey.
My man, it's been so long. It's been like 36 hours since I've seen you. It's I miss you.
And the last thing we did together was eat In-N-Out, which made Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. very happy. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, it was awesome. And you would think that Jake always talks so much trash about In-N-Out, yet he got two double cheeseburgers
and destroyed them. Because one's not filling enough. And Whataburger, you get a Texas-sized burger, and it's enough. I got to get two to fill me up at In-N-Out.
Jake secretly loves In-N-Out, and one day he will finally
I've never hated on In-N-Out. I just think it's vastly overrated, and it takes two burgers of those little tic-tac things you call burgers to fill me up.
And that's because the In-N-Out burgers aren't saturated with a bunch of water.
We're not going
to
get
that joke. Has never been funny. You keep going back to the water joke. It's never been funny.
It's water burgers.
We're not going to get too far off topic, but I do want to point out that in a way that Kevin's dad said during the live show that the show just exists in the real world, and literally the episodes are just when we turn the microphones on. We're at In-N-Out Burger after the Critics' Choice Awards. We're way overdressed. We're the most overdressed people in an In-N-Out Burger. And I approach Jake and Kevin, who are in a heated argument about the menu at In-N-Out not featuring all of the items. And I was like, I feel like
stupid.
I'm in the show.
It's like, look how simplistic we are.
Yeah, it's
except
beautiful.
For these secret things that everyone knows about because they're not really secret. Just put it on the freaking menu then. You're not cool because you have a secret menu if everybody knows about it. It's not a secret.
I just don't understand why Whataburgers are dripping with water. Why do they cook them in that? That's the worst joke. Watery. Yes. Yeah, I don't understand
it's
it.
It's never right. been funny.
It's time for the weekly poll. The weekly poll that we posted on our social media page, and if you want to follow us, we are at Real Blend on Twitter, is should we do more live shows in the future? For people who might not have known, for our 100th episode, we did a live show in Washington, D.C. at the AMC Georgetown 14. Big thank you to AMC Theaters for hosting our location. And it immediately got us thinking, well, that went really well. We had a really good time. It was amazing interacting with a bunch of new blenders who came out to D.C. to meet us. And we thought, should we do more of those? Well, 12.8% of the people said, nah, they didn't really want us to, which means that 87% of you agreed that we should do more live shows in the future. So what Gabe would like us to do, producer Gabe, is to solicit feedback. Like what did you guys like about the live show? What do you think we could improve as we continue to do more events like this going into 2020? Obviously, with the show, we're always looking for ways to evolve it. We're going to be bringing new segments to the show. We're constantly on the hunt for bigger interviews, people that we can get, directors, stars, all sorts of talent involved in the movies that you guys care about that we can bring to the show. But as you guys listen to the live show specifically, drop us an email or hit us up on social and let us know what you thought about the show, how it played out. You can send us emails to realblend@cinemablend.com. And we really hope, again, to do something like this in the future and just want to make it the best experience possible.
Sean, I've got to tell you, that 12%, that was my mom and dad.
Yeah.
They were very disappointed that the McCarthy's got so much love, and they really hope that 2020 is the Hamilton's time.
Yeah, Jan and Keith are really upset, and they voted all those. Yeah,
what the hell they said.
With no disrespect to the McCarthys, who are beautiful people, I'm Team Hamilton. I'm Team Hamilton for 2020. This is
Team Hamilton. My mom's been nothing but supportive. She's our only fan.
How quickly Sean turned.
Oh my God! What just happened? My parents were there. My dad said something
we
nice.
Stayed at Kevin's house.
Team Hamilton. What have Jan and Keith done for the show? Come on, what's going on here?
All right, Oscar.
Jill and Joe, come on. Those
have not had a chance to do the show since the Academy Awards revealed their selections for the 2020, the upcoming 2020 Oscar nominations. We want to touch on, obviously, we're not going to go beat by beat over every category, but we all talked before the show to pick out things that we want to highlight And, you know, it's mainly going to go to snubs. And so the one I'm going to start with is one that hit us right off the bat, or hit me right off the bat. And Jakey, to this point, if you want to even mention that you who you were sitting with at Critics' Choice, I was kind of stunned that Uncut Gems got completely overlooked. You know, like
here's the question that I asked Kevin before you got here, though. Yeah. What did you realistically think it was going to get? Because I honestly thought, like, at best, the Safdies might get a screenplay nomination. I never really thought Adam was in for actor. Okay. I didn't think that they were in for director. I didn't think they were getting that fifth director spot. I mean, editing, you know, but editing's usually so tied with best picture. I didn't know was really going to get a best picture nomination. Like, realistically, what did you actually expect it to get?
I would have liked to see, like I said, editing. I would have liked to see screenplay.
Yeah.
In another year, I could have seen director.
In another year, I could have seen Sandler. Not this year,
for sure. Yeah, I get it, but it's
I'm
strangely totally overlooked.
I
thought 100% it was gonna. If you would have said before the Oscars nominations came out, and you would have had me put money on what Uncut Gems would have gotten, these would have been my 100% locks. Sandler for actor.
You thought Sandler was 100% lock?
No question. I thought he was locked
in. He didn't get a SAG nomination? He didn't get a Golden Globe nomination?
I know. And that to me was part of the reason.
Critics' Choice, we nominate 84 different people, so that doesn't really mean as much.
But here's my thought process. Sandler was actually, there was a narrative going on from Sandler's interview he did with Howard Stern. And I'm not saying this is what would have prompted a Best Actor nomination. But there was a narrative in the media about Adam Sandler possibly getting an Oscar nomination. That was an actual story.
Sure.
The idea of it not getting a SAG or a Golden Globe nomination led me to believe that even it had more of a chance to get a Best Actor nomination, because you look at, why did Argo win Best Picture? Because Affleck did not get a Best Director nomination. It wasn't because it was the best movie of the year. It was because that everybody rallied behind and felt bad because Affleck didn't get nominated. That's my personal opinion on that take. So I would have thought Best Actor, no question. Picture, for sure. No question it had a picture chance. Director, I would argue that was out of left field, probably not going to happen. I wish it did. They deserve to be there more than Mendez does, or even Bong Joon-ho. But I think Uncut Gems was probably the biggest snub. And staying with the comedy aspect of it, Sandler and Eddie Murphy, both of those are gigantic snubs. And this goes back to what I've been saying on this show for a long time. Comedic actors and comedy will never be taken seriously by the Academy. I know Melissa McCarthy was nominated for Bridesmaids. I get that. But the idea of comedy has never been taken seriously. That's why I always joke about Dumb and Dumber and films like Happy Gilmore, which are brilliant films, but they're always considered to be bathroom humor movies. So I think Murphy, while it was a comedic performance, it was the best thing he'd done since Nutty Professor, 100% deserved to be in there. And Sandler, they can't take him seriously because of all the fart jokes he's done over the years on his comedy album. So I think that there is a bias towards people who are comedic actors, and that's why they didn't get nominated.
Well, to that end, and that speaks a little bit to what I think was another huge snub, which was Jennifer Lopez. Like, the Academy what I'm saying is, the Academy doesn't necessarily go for an actress who's doing something contemporary. They would much rather see a period piece. Like, look at the Best Actress category, which I'm going to transition us into. Renee Zellweger for Judy. Cynthia Erivo for Harriet. Saoirse Ronan for Little Women. Now, okay, Scarlett gets it for Marriage Story, but she was head and shoulders, you know, terrific.
But why did Scarlett get a supporting actress nomination for Jojo Rabbit? I don't even remember her in that film.
Oh, see, no, I do think she was
terrific. I don't remember her in that movie at all. I mean,
I thought she was pretty great in that.
I don't love Jojo Rabbit, though. But
I don't really like Jojo Rabbit either, but I thought her scenes were fantastic.
But okay, but let's be honest, though. J-Lo did not deserve an Oscar nomination for Hustlers. Like, I'm sorry. I get that we live in a world where people want to give J-Lo an Oscar nomination, but you don't get an Oscar for being J-Lo in a movie that's better than J-Lo's movies normally are.
Yeah. Hey,
sorry. Like, it's like Kathy Bates, I actually think deserved, because you could argue Kathy Bates took her spot, right?
Yeah.
I think Kathy Bates deserved
her or Florence Pugh.
I think both of them deserved it way over J-Lo.
Okay. If you were gonna give J-Lo a nomination, you would have given it to her for Selena or Out of Sight.
100%. 100%. But she wasn't J-Lo then. She was still right. Jennifer Lopez.
And that's the thing. Like, Jake and I aren't coming from an idea here that we don't want J-Lo to be nominated for an Oscar. We just didn't think that J-Lo's performance in Hustlers was Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with any bias towards J-Lo. I honestly genuinely think, and people online get so mad, like, oh, she deserved an award. But why? Is it because, like Jake just said, is it because she's Jennifer Lopez? Yes. Is it because it creates that narrative? So to me, her not getting nominated, while I would call it an official snub because everyone predicted it would happen. So technically speaking, it is a snub. But I don't think she should have been nominated for that.
The opposite of what we're saying about Adam Sandler. Because, like, yes, I would like to live in a world where Adam Sandler had an Oscar nomination.
But he deserved it.
Like, he put in the performance with Uncut Gems.
And you don't think
J-Lo
she did?
J-Lo did not. No.
I think she was good,
but, like, Oscar-worthy good? No. No.
I think J-Lo is very good. J-Lo is very good in Hustlers. And this is going to be a completely dissenting.
Oscar-worthy good?
No. This is going to be a dissenting opinion. You know who's better than J-Lo in Hustlers? Constance Wu.
You're absolutely right. 100%.
Is much better. It's less flashy. It's more internal. It's more of a dramatic performance. It's a harder performance, in my personal opinion.
Hold on. Let me ask a question then. Laura Dern's probably going to win. Is her performance in Marriage Story Oscar worthy?
130,000%.
Here's my only knock, is that it's very similar to her performance in Big Little Lies. That's my only knock about Laura Dern's performance.
I think Dern is phenomenal.
I feel like she's kind of played that character, not just before, but like last year.
Listen, I think she's very good in the movie. Yes? If I were ranking the performances in that movie, and I'm speaking totally honest from the heart, Adam Driver, Scarlett Johansson, Alan Alda,
all the above,
Ray Liotta, Laura Dern.
Yeah, I would argue with Sean, she's not even the best lawyer in that movie.
You want me to tell you something interesting? When I look back on Marriage Story, I don't think of Adam, Scarlett, any of those actors. The first thing that hits my mind is her speech about God and the Virgin Mary.
It's so overblown. It's not even really like, it's like a 30-second moment.
First of all, you can give credit to Noah for the writing. Yes, it's all his writing.
Absolutely.
But it's the delivery of that monologue.
And I think, I think the scene with her and Ray Liotta when they're going back and forth in the court, tearing into each other, that's more of an Oscar scene than her speech. I thought that speech had a lot of hype going into it, and I am with Jake in that it didn't have the same impact. I think she's great in the movie. I'm not saying she's not, but she looks like she's going to win that category, and I don't think she's the best performance in the film. So.
This comes down to perspective, though, and I think this is something interesting. When I sat down to watch Marriage Story, I had no idea this scene existed. Yeah, okay, yeah. So imagine me, I'm in a theater, Marriage Story is about to start, the movie's on. I mean, Rian Johnson was like sitting three seats in front of me because we live these insanely weird lives. And all of a sudden that scene hits. And it wasn't my mind going, that's an Oscar scene. It was my mind going, that is one of the best performances I've seen by an actor in a long time. Now, keep in mind what you both just said was the idea of it being hyped and overblown. If you saw that scene after everyone was talking about it, I could see that mindset being a piece of that thought process. But imagine seeing it without the hype. That's hard. It's hard to judge it without the hype if you didn't know about it or did know about it. But my experience was not knowing, and it blew my mind. I thought it was an incredible.
I mean, I knew the hype behind Joaquin Phoenix's Joker performance, but it was still blown away by that, hype or no hype.
But Joker was pretty divisive, though. There was a divisive nature of Joker that there were people who loved it, people who hated it. Marriage Story's been pretty universally.
This is a topic for another day, but when did it become cool to hate Joker? Like, did that? Oh my God, I woke up.
So I just did a video for this. That's going to be on Cinema Blend's YouTube page.
Like, I feel like I woke up one day and like was in the minority when the day before I was in the majority. Like what? Like I'm not allowed to like Joker now?
No, you can't.
I have never seen a movie that I thought was considered to be great. Though I will say it has a 69% of Rotten Tomatoes, which is actually super interesting. But you think about a movie that was so well received. Right? I saw Jake smile. But I do wonder. You're Jake's right though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's seen, I mean, if you looked at social media yesterday or any trending topics or any articles, people hated Todd Phillips for getting nominated for Best Director, like it was his fault somehow. And two, they hate Joker. They think it's, I mean, I have seen so many people just trashing this film. And like, where did this come from? Where did it come from?
I have no idea. So, all right, I want to get to one other category, or another category, our next category. For this reason specifically, Best Actress, Kevin, I think, was one of the loudest supporters of Lupita Nyong'o getting a nomination. And I know is disappointed that she didn't get it. So, Kevin, I'll ask you, of the five that are here, Charlize Theron for Bombshell, Renee Zellweger for Judy, Cynthia Erivo for Harriet, Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story, Saoirse Ronan for Little Women, do you put Lupita above all of them, most of them? Where does she stand?
Well, I mean, last year, Lupita Nyong'o delivered the best performance from any actor I had seen. And that goes across actor and actress for me personally. I just think that the performance was physically incredibly demanding. She played two roles. It was just a brilliant performance. But that movie just kind of fell off, unfortunately. It was my top five of the year. I am genuinely shocked. Now, no, am I shocked she didn't get nominated? No. I think we all had a fear that she wouldn't, right? I think there was a lot of talk about her not being in the conversation. No one was discussing her. Did she get a SAG nomination?
I think she
for
did.
For us?
I think she did, too.
Because that's what's interesting
to me. She didn't get Golden Globe.
But she got a SAG, which,
like, the question
if she
becomes,
did.
Like, because the actors nominate in the actor branch, you know, and it just makes me think, like, did they not watch, how does an actor not watch that performance and recognize
it? Right. That's what I'm curious about.
Does the release date and the fact that it's a horror film hurt it? And you can't come back with, well, what about Get Out? Because Get Out was such an anomaly and such big breaking onto the scene for Jordan Peele.
It's not the release date per se, because Universal pushed that. You know, like, we got screeners.
It was
of
a
it
divisive
from
film.
I mean, it could be. It might be what Kevin's speaking to with comedy, that it's also that for horror.
Yeah.
Also, but I think that there was plenty of attention on Jordan's follow-up movie. It was well received, and at the time, everybody raved about her performance. So I don't know what happened, And I know that Focus has to be delighted that Cynthia Erivo got in for Harriet, but I haven't seen that movie. I don't know anybody who has seen that movie, to be honest with you. I'm going to check it out. I have a screener of it. I just never got to it. And truthfully, I'm not that interested in getting to it. It just seems like one of those films that's going to feel like homework. And we get a couple of them every single year. And, you know, I'm trying to think of a recent example, but for her to break through, that stunned me. Because
Cynthia Erivo is genuinely an amazing actress.
She's an amazing actress, yes.
And she was in, I mean, it honestly,
she should have got nominated for Widows. Bad times.
Yeah. But Widows is such an interesting topic. And I think we should do a show episode one time, maybe like a blend game, where we talk about a movie that just didn't connect somehow, but it was great. You know what I mean? Like True Romance, for example, made no money at all, and no one really knows what it is, but it's such a brilliant film. And then you look at something like Widows, or there are so many films that fall, and I wonder why they fall. Like Widows was great, and you think of Cynthia Erivo, she was amazing. I don't love Bad Times at El Royale, but she's great in that movie. And I just think that, she's a powerhouse, so
Lupita did get the SAG nomination, to break in real fast.
Did Cynthia get a SAG nomination?
Let me check all the other nominees. I went right to Us's page.
Because that genuinely surprised me when they read Cynthia's name. I don't remember her that being a part of, was that ever a big part of the conversation for the Oscar race?
I'm sorry, I stand corrected. Cynthia Erivo got the SAG also.
Well, then there we go. So, then you know what? It's funny. Maybe that was kind of a... Let's call that our big surprise.
Excuse me. I suck for not checking out Harriet. Apparently, I am well behind the times in giving that movie the due, moving its due.
It's a great story.
Let me shift over to the... Oh, this is controversial. My God. All right, everyone, strap in. The fifth director slot. Wow.
Our text chain was lit yesterday.
The four that we basically said were locks made it in, and that would be Scorsese, Tarantino, Bong Joon-ho, and Sam Mendes. Those seem to be the four that were going to get in regardless, and then that fifth slot, theoretically, had a number of names that could have broken through. And then it's, you know, of course, the conflict becomes there were nine Best Picture nominations, there can only be five directors. So there's going to be some films... where the movie got into the Best Picture conversation, but the director does not. I would say that the loudest...
Which makes no sense, by the way.
Well, right.
It should correlate.
Okay, those, but then that should correlate. Then do you... So you think picture should be locked at 5 no matter what?
Yes, stop it. Picture should be locked at 5. Because let's be honest, yeah. The other 4, it seems like a also-ran.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, Jojo
Ford,
Rabbit,
Ford versus
Best
Ferrari.
Picture.
Like I love
now,
Ford
versus Ferrari.
No,
happy.
I love Ford versus Ferrari, but the fact that Mangold isn't nominated for director means it doesn't even have a shot.
And Jake's great point there, because Ford vs. Ferrari is a masterfully directed film. Because
such a director film.
Think about that chemistry between Bale and Damon. That's what a director does, and that's why that film sings. And like it's Ford vs. Ferrari is that beautiful blend of technical and emotion. It just hits every cylinder. No pun intended. It's just so well done.
In any other year, I'd be arguing that Ford vs. Ferrari is the most Academy film ever. You know,
it's a great movie.
It checks it all the boxes of a film that in any other year would be sweeping categories. And so I was, thrilled to see it get a Best Picture nomination. You know, I'm happy that movie can always call itself a Best Picture nominee because I love that film and it didn't make my top 10, but it was right there on the cusp the whole time. It's really well made. And you're exactly right. It's such a director driven project and
huge.
It's got Mangold's fingerprints all over it. But right now we're looking at a bunch of people who are up for that best director slot. It goes to Todd Phillips and The Internet Melts. And again, it speaks to like what world are we living in where all of a sudden Todd Phillips, like he made another Due Date movie or what was the one he made with Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis?
It's Due Date. Yeah.
That called Due Date?
Yeah.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles too.
Like, okay, and so I understand, like, obviously we want, there's a push for diversity, you know, and does Greta Gerwig deserve a Best Director nomination? Of course. You know, I think she was terrific. I think work she did for Little Women is terrific.
In a year as good as 2019, the downside of having a year with so many great movies means that there are going to be a lot of people who deserve nominations who just don't get one.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry that Greta Gerwig, sure, was absolutely deserving to be nominated for Best Director. But at the end of the day, she also directed a movie that's been made 4 other times, which didn't help Bradley Cooper last year, who also was left off the Best Director list.
Was he? This is how important it is. I totally forgot.
Right.
Like, isn't it crazy that Bradley Cooper, didn't Star Is Born win one Oscar?
Isn't Bradley Cooper a nominee this year? Isn't he a producer on Joker?
Yeah. All right.
I want to say one
thing. Can we throw out the hot take real fast? We have to throw out the hot take.
Can I
Kevin
say one
doesn't
thing
about Greta Gerwig? I was going to say, please.
Just real fast. And I know what you're going to say. But I put a lot of thought into this Greta Gerwig thing recently. And if you know, I guess, Sean, you're going to get to a point where you're going to ask us who we would replace in that list. And I'm not sure if we've gotten there yet. But my point being, I was thinking about Greta Gerwig and what she did with Little Women. It's almost more impressive what she did if you think about it, considering it's been done so many times. She still found a fresh way to do it. Yeah. And that nonlinear storytelling of it, you got to think about the role of a director, right?
Greta Gerwig's role. That's a screenplay, right? She got a screenplay nomination.
Yeah, but on set, the director's job is really to tell your actors where you are in the movie, right? So if they're jumping back and forth between these 7 years at a time, and she has to be able to talk to Saoirse and go, all right, you're 7 years earlier here, but just a heads up, emotionally, you've already hit this arc. That's the job of a director. And you think about the emotions of that film and the nonlinear storytelling,
that's not the number one job of a director.
But it's a big job for the director.
I mean, but on the flip side of that, Spielberg directed E.T. in chronological order. Does he not get credit?
Oh, no. I'm not saying that you have to direct the movie in nonlinear or linear. I'm saying you have to tell your actors where they are emotionally. And I felt when I watched Little Women that I was always succinct with where they were. And I think that's a lot to do with Greta Gerwig's direction. And the shooting on 35, I know it's her DP, but she still made that choice.
Yeah, but all directors do that because most directors shoot out of chronological order.
I think what Kevin's also saying too is that the director is responsible for putting together the ultimate cut, you know, like in the editing room, assembling that story in a way that's going to touch an audience. And
do you think Todd Phillips should be taken out in exchange for Greta Gerwig?
I'll tell you who I should think should be taken out.
I would have been fine with if that happened.
But do you think it should happen? If you had the choice, if the Academy came to you and said, Sean, If you want us to, we will take out Todd Phillips and put in Greta Gerwig. Would you say yes?
No, I will not, because Joker, to me, on my top 10, ranked higher than Little Women.
There you go. There you go.
I would remove two of the directors and put two others in.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I think Sam Mendes and Bong Joon-ho.
How do you take out Mendes?
Let him finish.
You remove them and you put Greta Gerwig and the Safdies. I think that is a better best.
I want to I just need to establish up front the ground rules of what's happening here. Kevin likes 1917 a lot.
I do,
but doesn't love it. Jake and I think 1917 is terrific, and we've been having a conversation off show in the other part of the show that happens when you guys don't happen to be listening, about how 1917, according to Jake and I, is exactly the type of movie that should and does get Academy recognition. Kevin keeps comparing it to Green Book, and it's driving both of us up.
Okay. First of all, I said the only comparison to Green Book was the idea that it's a... Okay, first of all, 1917 is a very good movie. I think it's technically more impressive than it is emotionally. Also, I would rather watch a two-hour version of the movie being filmed than the movie itself. I think that's more impressive. That behind-the-scenes featurette is better than anything in the whole movie. Now, two things here. I think that Sam Mendes is a brilliant filmmaker. American Beauty, everything he's done, Skyfall. I just don't think 1917 is that impressive emotionally. And I think, technically speaking, the film does work on a technical level. But as a director... I don't remember the characters. I have forgotten about the characters. I've forgotten about the story. All I keep hearing people say is how brilliant the cinematography is and how well it's shot. And to me, that is not the story. That is the tech side of the filmmaking. So in my opinion, Sam Mendes, I think the Safdies directed a much better emotional arc with Adam. I think that Greta directed a much better emotional arc with her characters. Mendez's characters are not memorable. They're not. And that to me is a problem. That's my issue with the movie.
Okay, excellent. My transition into the very next point. Kevin, right now, what wins Best Picture?
1917.
No, I think we split. I think we get a split. I think Hollywood wins Picture and Mendez wins Director.
Okay.
See, if that happens, honestly, with Hollywood winning at the Critics' Choice and the Comedy Musical Award at the Globes, I'm starting to feel slightly better. Because 1917, the only reason why Green Book comes into this, and Sean, I you have to give me 30 seconds to at least say why I mentioned Green Book. Green Book was a very good movie that won Best Picture last year, in my opinion, because of preferential ballot. It was probably the most equally liked film out of everybody among the Academy. I think 1917 is a perfect crowd-pleasing type movie that falls into that same category where everyone equally likes it. I'm not saying it's on Green Book's level. Green Book obviously is not technically as masterful as something like 1917. I compare 1917 to something like Avatar. I think Avatar was a mind-blowing technical concept that came out and blew everyone's minds, but no one cared about the story. I'm not saying people don't care about 1917 story, but to me, when I walked away from 17, it was just like walking away from Avatar. Cool visually, but I just didn't care about the characters.
Jakey, what wins Best Picture?
I think Hollywood wins Picture and Mendez wins Director. I think we see a split.
I would honestly, if that happens, I will be very happy, because then if Quentin gets screenplay and he gets picture, I would.
Would you rather if 1917 were going to win one and Hollywood were going to win the other, how would you like it to go with director and picture?
I would rather Quentin Tarantino. Now, see, here's the thing. I think Best Picture comes with a very special weight, and when you award a film Best Picture, it's saying something. And while Green Book won Best Picture last year and no one's talking about it, it still said something that it won. So I would rather see Hollywood win Picture and Mendez take Director if he has to over Quentin. I would rather see Bong Joon-ho take Director over Sam Mendez, personally. So I have no idea what's going to happen, but I do think that the Best Picture this year is going to go to 17. It's the one that just fits that perfect middle of the road vibe for all the members, in my opinion.
Sean, what do you think?
I think that Hollywood's going to win Picture. I think Bong Joon-ho is going to win Director. I think people love Parasite.
They do. He's going to win, I think.
And I don't think that they're ready yet to give a film best foreign language and picture. And it's definitely going to win best foreign language. Mm-hmm. But I, like a Roma, I see a Roma situation where Alfonso got recognized in director and Bong Joon-ho will get recognized in director. And then Hollywood will win for picture because A, it's a movie about the industry. We know they love. I do feel that there is a pressure in the industry from people because this, we know that it's politics. Like there's a lot of politics involved in the voting. And I do think that they right now see that Quentin Tarantino, a director that they respect, might only do one more film.
Mm, and, I know and, you're
that,
going.
And that film is no slam dunk to be universally praised, you know, or like it could be a hardcore One Direction where Tarantino fanatics love it, but the rest of the industry is like, didn't work. But this one right now, he's got it. Like it's there. People love it. It's got great performances, you know, honor him now and give him the best picture. But I'm torn with both of you that I don't know. I couldn't tell you right now which one Tarantino would prefer. Would he rather call himself an Oscar-winning director, or would he rather have a film that wins picture? I don't really know.
I think Tarantino would say he'd rather have an Oscar-winning best picture and then the screenplay award. I really do. And like Sean wrote a great article recently, which you can go on Cinema Blend to read, about the historical significance of what Quentin would achieve Oscar night if it happens. And he would then tie Woody Allen for the, I think, the three winning screenplays, original screenplays, and he would have done it in a shorter period of time. And Sean wrote a great article about it.
Much
but
shorter.
It is, but in your article, you do say that he seems to be more focused or seems to be more importance on screenplay. Like that seems more important to him. And I think that, I don't know, I think this year is interesting. I do want to ask both of you a very interesting question. I want you to be very honest with me. How many times have you seen 1917?
Three.
Okay.
Three
times.
Three or four.
And you walk away thinking about those characters. I haven't thought about them once since I saw it. Once.
Well, I'll say the first time through, I focused on the technical aspect. The second time through, I was more dialed into their story.
Yeah. And I am in the extreme minority.
His last scene. Yeah. When he realizes, not to get into spoilers, when he realizes he has to run. Like, I'm getting chills just like that. It, to me, is one of the most powerful scenes of last year. Like,
then where is his Oscar nomination for Best Actor?
Where, I mean, you can't do that. I mean, then I mean, like, you can't discount someone's performance because they didn't get an Oscar nomination because then I'll just turn around and do that with Adam Sandler.
One of the most powerful scenes of the year. That's what I'm saying. Like performance-wise, you're saying.
Yeah, but there are a lot of, I mean, that's an obtuse argument. Like, there are a lot of great performances that didn't get Oscar nominations. It doesn't mean they didn't have great scenes.
I'll say the first time through, I was really caught up with how is he going to continue the shot? How is he going to, like, as major things happened, I will admit that the unbroken shot distracted me from it. Second time through, I was all in on the emotion.
But we also, we forget that we are not the average moviegoer. We recognize that kind of stuff a lot more. I talk to people at work and they go, oh yeah, the whole shot thing was really cool. But like, oh my God, what a film. Like we pay attention to that stuff a lot more. And just because we followed it doesn't mean that it's lacking in anything else. It just means that we know it a little bit more than everyone else does.
Here's what's bothering me about 1917, and then we'll move on. 1917 is being hailed, and I said this earlier, as more of a technical achievement than anything else. If you look at Twitter, if you look at social media, if you look at the way people are reacting to the movie, they're talking about the cinematography.
So was Gravity.
Hold on. And not the characters. Gravity had great characters and very memorable characters, in my opinion. But that being said, 1917 has been done before. And people are acting like 1917 is new. This one shot concept has actually been done as one shot in films like Russian Ark and Victoria. Go back to 48 with Rope when he was stitching shots together behind Jimmy Stewart's black jacket.
You would give his director position to Greta Gerwig, who made a movie that's been made four other times.
So no, I'm talking about the technical aspects of 1917. Nothing in 1917 has been done before.
But not to the degree that they did it in 1917.
What degree? Birdman did it 3 years ago with better characters.
In the back of a stage, not across. No,
he was going through New York, not across Europe. Are you kidding me? He's flying out of a window in one scene. Birdman is all over the place.
Dude,
just because it's a tight
space. You have to understand
space.
That Birdman was technically easier than 1917. Sean, back
no,
up.
It was not.
Yes, it absolutely was.
Oh, now, you're talking about like, the physicalities of building these sets. Sure, yes,
wait,
it's outside
Gabe,
and it's exteriors.
On.
I get it.
Gabe, should I drop in the Chivo versus Deacon No, I'm kidding.
Not today, sir.
They're both amazing cinematographers.
Way too much to get. Chivo versus Deacon is a whole.
Let me ask you a question.
We gotta go.
Jake and Sean, answer me yes or no. Is 1917 the best movie of 2019? Tell me that question.
No. Okay. No, we never said that. No one said that.
What does that question even mean?
Last minute hot takes. Jake, you wanted to mention John Williams.
I just feel like, I don't know, everyone's been sleeping on this, but I feel like a man who received his 52nd Oscar nomination deserves to get a shout out. So it's just that John Williams got his 52nd Oscar nomination for a little film called Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. He is the most nominated living person. He's only second to Walt Disney. And I don't know, I just feel like, you know, we're talking about, you know, this person getting, you know, Scarlett Johansson got 2 nominations in 1 year, and it's like, okay, that's cute. John Williams got his 52nd nomination. I just feel like I feel like we should never sleep on that, even if he gets nominated every year.
I also want to point out, when he got his nomination, I thought, oh, wait, hold on. That category might have just blown up, because I could see the nostalgia aspect of him doing his last Star Wars one, powering him through, because otherwise it was going to be the girl from Joker, whose name Hilder.
Hilder's going to win.
That's her last name. Yeah. I thought so too, because she's won almost everything up to this point. And then when I saw John Williams' name get dropped, I thought, I don't know. Kevin, you got one hot take. One hot take from the Oscar nomination.
I'll tell you, I'm actually going to use my hot take to tell you a quick little story about Hilder. I was at the Critics' Choice Awards. I was at the Joker table. Thank you to Warner Brothers for putting me there. So I was there with Joaquin Phoenix, Lawrence Shear, the cinematographer, Todd Phillips, and then Hilder. And we're at this moment in the show where they're giving away awards off air. And two of my seatmates, Lawrence Shear and Hilder, are both in those off air things. Hilder wins. And they just tell her that on a TV screen. I watched her learn she won by looking at a TV screen. And so while I'm there and Joaquin Phoenix wins, right? It's the first award of the night. And I'm just sitting right across from the guy. And it was just surreal. And he remembered our podcast. I shook his hand. I was like, you were on our show. He goes, I remember. Yeah, it was great. You know, he was really cool about it in his own Joaquin Phoenix type of way. So I just wanted to mention to any new listeners we have on our show, if you haven't gone back, check out our Joaquin Phoenix interview. It was 35 minutes. And our Todd Phillips interview for Joker. These are interviews we did later last year. But if you're new, you might not have heard them. Go back, because they're really cool. And Phoenix was so great to us. And we just want to say thank you again to Warner Brothers for allowing us to have that time with them, you know?
My hot take, and then we'll move on, is the Best Supporting Actor category. Because, mother of God, that murderer's row of talent is just... I mean, in what given year have you seen...
No.
Well, you won't see Pesci. You know, How often is he Pacino?
Yeah.
How often is Pacino
doing? I put forward the question, is this the greatest or the most stacked acting category ever? Because I think it absolutely, I mean, Pitt, Pacino, Pesci, Hopkins, and Hanks.
Yeah.
And one person said that, and I did not know this, best actor in 1973, John Lemmon, Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford. that's a pretty damn stacked category too. But I'd say this year's supporting actor is neck and neck. It's right there.
Yeah. That's amazing. And
we might see a category like that once in our lifetime.
These categories are locked, right? These four, the actors are locked.
Yeah, and that's
right?
What I was going to say. Like, to that end, Brad Pitt looks like he's going to win it, and I think Brad Pitt deserves it. And we have said this before, he deserves an Oscar as an actor. You know, he has one for producing in 12 Years a Slave, but he's finally going to get one for directing. And I'm equally thrilled that he's going to get one for being directed by Quentin Tarantino. I think that's
Is Irishman slipping? Irishman going to be like Star Is Born and not win anything?
Remember, Scorsese already has a movie that went 0 for 10 at the Oscars. Gangs of New York went 0 for 10.
Did it really?
Yeah. Gangs of New York. Everyone thought that Daniel Day-Lewis was going to win for Bill the Butcher, but that's the year Adrian Brody won. So he could go back to that travesty.
Yeah.
So
what?
He could have 2 movies that go 0 for 10.
If they win one, what would they win?
A screenplay. Screenplay.
Adapted screenplay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That screenplay is fantastic. I want to give recognition to that screenplay because it's brilliant. I've pointed this out when I reviewed it. I know Irishman's my number one. There's 3 frame stories that are being juggled in that screenplay. And he lands all 3 of them beautifully.
I'm with you. If that one adapted, I'd be with you. Let me ask you, of the 4 acting categories, which one has the most potential for an upset?
Maybe Laura Dern.
I think actress.
I think Joaquin's a lock. Yeah, actress could get upset. Yeah. I mean,
you know why?
Like, feels like Renee has the momentum, but who?
Glenn Close. Remember what happened with Glenn Close?
Yeah.
True. Yeah,
that's
very true.
She won everything. I always get nervous whenever, like, you know, a month out we're saying, oh, the four acting categories are locked, because they're very rarely truly locked.
Yeah, I would be very fascinated to see. If Renee Zellweger doesn't win, who takes it? Charlize Theron or Scarlett Johansson?
Scarlett? I'd say Scarlett from Marriage Story.
Scarlett from Marriage Story. Yeah.
I think. Does Driver have a chance anymore? Is Phoenix locked?
I think Phoenix is locked.
I think Phoenix is locked.
I'm happy that Phoenix is locked. Yeah, okay.
I don't mean to sound, you know, I very much am okay living in a world. And also, we now have two characters that have both, that two different actors have won for playing.
Well, listen, hasn't happened yet, so.
Was Nicholson nominated for Batman?
No, I don't think Nicholson got nominated.
Nicholson wasn't nominated for Batman, was he?
I don't know. That's a good question.
For Joker?
He's great in that movie, but he's Jack Nicholson.
Yeah,
I know, but I'm just curious.
All right, this week in movies. Did either of you see Doolittle?
I have not.
Eddie Murphy.
What?
You know what's funny? You know what's funny, Sean? When it comes to this week in movies, you can say that we always do little and not see any of these. And we always do very little and not see these.
I guess we've been bad boys.
In a few hours.
For life.
I know Kevin and I are both seeing. Are you seeing it tonight too, Jake?
I have to go see the Tyler Perry movie.
Oh.
It's screening. They're screening at the same time. I know, because Tyler Perry's coming to Chicago tomorrow. I'm interviewing him. So I've got to go see that. I have to skip Bad Boys and go see the Tyler Perry movie.
All right.
Tyler Perry would tell you to go to Bad Boys.
Yes, he would.
He would, because it's...
Kevin, we can react on social tonight. So once you guys have listened to this episode, go to our social media, and Kevin and I will post what our reactions to Bad Boys for Life are, because we're going to go see it in a few hours. Yes.
Can I just point out that I'm recording this in LA and I'm sitting right on top of where they're doing the premiere tonight. So I'm looking out this window and I can see the Bad Boys for Life red carpet. Sean and I are gigantic. I think Jake is too. We're gigantic buddy cop movie fans. But Bad Boys 2 is one of my all time favorite films. Like, I've seen it over and over and over, and more. My wife gets so mad. I watch it all the time, and so I am super excited, but I'm also super hesitant because Bay is not involved. Where are you right now, Sean? I'm kind of getting
I'm in Charlotte.
I'm excited. No. No, I meant, like, where are you mentally on Bad Boys? I'm excited about it, man.
I saw a bunch of people tweet that it's good. Early New York reaction said that it's good. And so I'm starting to swing back around to hopeful. I'm starting to swing back around to hopeful. So, all right. We will have reactions up on our social media pages. You guys can see what the two of us thought about Bad Boys. This week's blend game is #SceneBlend. And when we announced it during the live show, the 100 show, we mentioned that the parameters were pretty loose. If you could defend the definition of a scene, then you could go ahead with it. It could be as long or as short as you needed it to be. That might lead to some debate. If someone mentions a scene and the other two guys say, nope, that is not a scene, then we'll get into a little bit more discussion about it. But and we had amazing interplay with people on social media sharing their favorite scenes. People were all over the place, which was fantastic. Jake, I'm told you get to go first.
My scene is, it's one of those cases, I feel like we say this a lot, where it was the first thing that popped up my head whenever we initially talked about doing this. And then I thought, okay, let me put that off to reserve. Let me put it off to the side and think about other scenes. And then but it's honestly probably the scene that I have most randomly throughout the day stopped what I was doing and just found it on YouTube and just watched it from start to finish. And it is the rainy T-Rex paddock breakout from Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
I mean, from them pulling up and the car stopping, the water in the cup and the plastic cup vibrating to signify the goat going missing, the first time you see the T-Rex. And let's just talk about the practicality, and I know Kevin's 100% with me on that, the practicality of the T-Rex. Stan Winston animatronics, it looks like a freaking T-Rex is there. When the T-Rex crashes through the top of the car onto the kids, when his snout blows the hat off of Alan Grant, when his pupils dilate because he looks in the window and the flashlight gets into his eyes. It's just perfectly tense. The rain is gorgeous, and I think the rain probably helps hide the fact that maybe even the CGI, I mean, it's 25 years old. The CGI is probably aged a little, but the rain kind of thing helps hide that. Yeah. All the kids' performances are great. The tension, the action, everything. It's beautifully directed. It's one of the probably Spielberg's top five sequences of direction. It's just absolutely frame for frame, absolutely gorgeous. That shot when his foot presses down into the mud. It's when it's just everything about it.
I like when he bites the tire. I don't know why I like that.
When he's like pulling the tire like a dog. Oh my God. And what's amazing is that it's almost instantly followed by two other amazing sequences when they're trying to climb down the tree, and then when the T-Rex chases Laura Dern and Jeff Goldblum in the Jeep while they're like trying to drive away. Those are also two amazing sequences. So the fact that it's not that and then dies down for half an hour, it's that and then has two more beats. But
The mirror. The objects are closer
than they appear. Everything about that is just brilliant.
Yeah.
So that is my favorite scene of all time. I get excited just talking about it.
Do you remember where you were the first time you saw it?
I do. My parents took me to go see it. I had to have been, honestly, I was five, and I remember my grandma said, sit next to me because you're going to get scared. And she screamed. She tells a story about it. I specifically remember when the Dilophosaurus goes after Newman. She screamed and went, Newman! Because she was a big Seinfeld fan. But I remember and you know, when you're 5 or 6 years old, that's when that's when you love dinosaurs, right? I mean, that's when dinosaurs are the coolest. So to have that movie come out when I was a child, I was so fortunate because I was so into dinosaurs. Oh, God, I love it. Absolutely love it.
All right, I get to go next, and I'm going to very briefly mention two scenes that didn't make the cut for me. The Few Good Men courtroom scene.
Yep.
And the Die Hard rooftop jump.
Two
perfection scenes for me.
Where are you going with this?
The Back to the Future clock tower scene.
Oh, great pick!
The Back to the Future clock tower scene is incredible to me. Every time I watch it, I'm convinced he won't make it. There's no way he can't.
I'm with you on that. I actually have that same feeling when I watched that scene. I'm like, is he actually going to make it this time?
It's incredibly well edited to the point where I am. I'll go beyond the most obvious how beautifully edited together it is and how Zemeckis, even in the moment, you can go far enough in that scene where it would take you out of it, where you'd be like, oh, all right, fine. And it's not, you know, too much. But like, you know, Doc plugs it in and then the tree branch falls and it disconnects at the bottom. And then he's got to get down to the bottom and replug it back in. You can only throw so many of those obstacles. But then so the first time you watch that movie, it's thrilling and you're on the edge of your seat. And is he going to make it? But then when you go back and start to put together that script and you realize that they tease the clock tower, you know, at the beginning with the girl, the woman who's trying to get him to volunteer, and she gives him the flyer. Like, just knowing you need to do that earlier on in your script so that Jennifer can write her number on the back of it so that Marty can have it when he gets to the past, you know, and then when the doc is like, oh, the only thing that would do that is a bolt of lightning. And you don't even make the connection then, right? Until he's like, oh, we do know when one's going to hit. And then the rest of the movie is like structured to get you to that point and all the little obstacles that are going to prevent it from getting there. That again, the highest compliment I can pay to that scene is that even though it's completely on film and done, I watch it a million times because it's one of those movies that the minute it's on, I throw the remote control. Doesn't matter where it is. And when I get to that scene, I'm convinced he's not going to make it. He stops long enough to write the note. The car doesn't start right away. He's got to headbutt it to get it going. And just the way that it is beautifully edited makes that that is my favorite scene of all time. I'm
great
calling that my favorite.
Great pick.
I love that scene. Kevin, you're last.
Yeah. It's funny because my scene is so much darker and more dialogue heavy. It's funny because I was thinking about a lot of these, when you guys were mentioning your scenes, if I was going down a path of a blockbuster type fun moment, I was thinking, I don't know, I was thinking about Squints and Sandlot when he fake drowns himself so he can get kissed by Wendy Peppercorn. Those are scenes that hit me as a kid. But I also had two other scenes that were in this realm, but I went kind of like what Jake said, what's the first scene that came to my head when I thought about scene blend? The other two that didn't make the cut but were right there were Heat with De Niro, Pacino, at the diner, which is arguably just one of the greatest scenes ever. And then Jay and Silent Bob's right back, Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season. But that's just me because I'm a fan of Kevin Smith. All right, I went with True Romance, Walken Hopper. Yes. And I'm going to preface this only because the dialogue in that scene is very brutal. So I'm coming at this from a filmmaking standpoint, what I like about the scene itself. Again, I'm not condoning what's said in the scene, obviously, but it's the setting of the scene. It's the perfect intersection of dialogue meets direction meets acting. You have these two heavy hitters across from each other, Walken and Hopper, spouting dialogue, and that dialogue that they're spouting in that scene is just as intense as any action movie I have ever seen. You're talking about a scene where two guys are fighting with words.
Yeah. Literally. Oh, what a great way of putting it. You're right.
And that's why I like the Heat scene so much too, because it's two guys basically discussing how they're going to kill each other over a cup of coffee, but being polite about it. And like, there's something special about that. So you go to True Romance, and the weight of that scene. So Clarence, Christian Slater's character has just left the house. Hopper's his father. Hopper knows that his son's gone to California with this suitcase full of drugs. And then the mob comes in, Walken's character. And just the line when he says, "Do you know who I am?" And he goes, "I am the Antichrist. You go tell the angels in heaven you've never seen evil so singularly personified as you did in the face of the man who killed you. My name is Vincent Cacciotti. I work for Blue Lube Oil." I this is all off the top of my head. I just the delivery of Walken's line. And then when the scene turns, there's a moment in that scene where Dennis Hopper genuinely realizes he's going to die, whatever he says. And you see the facial, it's almost like that facial expression moment in Breaking Bad when Walter goes from Walter White to Heisenberg as he lets Aaron Paul's girlfriend die. And so you think about that moment, and I love watching that scene because you look at Hopper's face and you go, oh, he's just going to use this moment to dig into this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he's like, I'm going to say the most messed up thing I could possibly think about. I'm already going to die. And I might as well, he wants to go out by making this guy mad, basically. The sound effect of the Chesterfield cigarette in his mouth as Hopper pulls that cigarette in, that crunchy sound, the way Tony Scott directs that scene, I mean, it's Quentin's dialogue. I would love to see what Quentin would have done with it. And then Gandolfini, right, standing right behind Hopper and pulling up that hand and slicing it open and giving him a rag. It was like this weird thing. Like they were hospitable about cutting his hand open. They were like, "Oh, we're gonna give you a rag and help you clean it off with some alcohol." I'm like, who does that? It was just really well detailed and oriented. Just the script, the dialogue, it just flows. But it's really more about the intensity of the moment. It's more about the turn. It's more about these two heavy hitters going at each other with just insanely brutal dialogue. And to me, that scene, that's the first time I ever saw a scene where I was like that's one of the great, that is the greatest scene I've ever seen put to film. Not content-wise, just the way it's done, the way it's written, the way it's delivered, well, and just the weight of the moment. That's why I love that scene.
And all of our scenes are woven into the fabric of the movies that are being told, which I find really interesting because a lot of times, you know, and when you learn about this with the behind-the-scenes stuff, where a production will be like, we got to do this scene, you know, and I don't care how you fit it in, but make it work. It's got to work this way, right? And right. A lot of times they're so clumsy, you know, because you know the buildup to get to it wasn't natural, or it's a great blockbuster tentpole moment, but everything around it sort of falls apart. And that's why you guys check out, and I'm just going to briefly recommend this, and then I'll go to the audience pick. So many people kept saying to me that show on Netflix, Movies That Made Us, they did one for Dirty Dancing and Ghostbusters, and they did one for Die Hard.
Die Hard.
And I watched it, cool. And everyone who's listening to this knows that Die Hard is my favorite movie of all time. I learned so much about that
second
movie.
Favorite movie.
Second favorite movie.
Endgame.
Sorry,
Endgame.
Endgame.
Used to that.
Sorry, Endgame, right over my shoulder here. It was amazing how much of that movie was written on the fly, and that, you know, they were reacting to things that were going wrong or not working, and they were in that Fox building was an actual working building at the time, so they couldn't do things at night. They couldn't do any gunfire scenes until after 5 p.m. because there were lawyers working in the building, essentially. And the mandate they were given by the producer, Joel Silver, at the beginning was, yeah, I don't care what you guys do, but the rooftop has to blow up. Like, I want to see the rooftop blow up. So they had to literally write to that moment, essentially. And then they got to the moment where they blew up the rooftop and they figured out how to do it. And then someone was like, okay, but I don't know if you guys remember, McLean's up there. And they were like, ah, yeah, how do we do that? And they've come up with a way to jump off the thing. So sometimes it can work and you can get yourself out of those moments. But I think the scenes that we all brought up and that the audience has brought up too, they're part of the story. You know, they're significant to the way that the story is flowing. And that fascinates me. Audience picks. Bruno said the basement scene in Bastards. I saw a lot of people said the opening scene of Bastards.
Yeah, I would say I would pick the opening scene. Yeah, but the basement scene's great too.
Manda 0101 said the No Man's Land scene from Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Let's see. Made me ugly cry in the theater. I never knew how much I needed a female superhero movie like this until I saw it. That's very nice.
Wow.
Shelby Jones, who actually came to our DC meetup and said hello to all of us. Hi, Shelby. Said Shelby. The throne room scene in The Last Jedi. Now, listen, I know you two hate The Last Jedi. Throne room scene is pretty spectacular. That's a really good scene.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
John Hanlon, who I got to see at Critics' Choice, hung out with me backstage for a little while, said the Normandy scene in Saving Private Ryan. Hard to argue.
Yeah.
Rachel Ho chose Dumb and Dumber when the cop rides up next to the dog van.
Been doing a little boozing, have you?
She shared.
Oh, man.
Scene
I was hoping for a little bathroom blend, a little sneaking in there a little bit, but they didn't go with that scene.
There was so much participation. You guys had amazing suggestions this week with Scene Blend. I hope you guys enjoyed our conversations and the movies that we decided to share. Next week, I'm pretty excited for this one. Y'all can follow along on Twitter. Play along with us. We are playing, and it's going to be tough. You're going to have to Google how to spell this. Hashtag Matthew McConaughey Blend. We're going to celebrate the talent of Matthew McConaughey. And I think that he gets overlooked as a performer a lot of times. Because he did go through a spell where he did a lot of these romantic comedies that kind of fell on their faces, but he's made some amazing films over the years. So hashtag Matthew McConaughey Blend. That is tied to The Gentleman, the new Guy Ritchie film, and the guys will be able to talk about that film, I think, next week. So, yes, Kevin.
I am going to full circle back to a one-sentence hot take that you asked me earlier what my hot take on the Oscars was.
Yes.
And this is gonna be a debatable thing we can get into later.
You're going to bring up something that we're going to want to yell at you for and then the show has to be over?
Take Sam Mendes out, put Jordan Peele in for us.
Dude.
I truly believe that.
I can understand why Kevin would say that.
I truly believe that.
Let's disagree with them on a different show. We have a review from Nurse Katie 22, who subject line for her review this week says, "Where do I even begin?" Which could go one way or the other, right? It could be very positive or extremely negative. And she says, "Okay, guys, I just have to say thank you. I am movie obsessed. And when I first started seeing Kevin's interviews on social media years ago, I thought, finally, someone who gets it. He didn't just ask all the, how'd you get so shredded for this movie? Or what was the biggest jokester on set? Kevin, you need to start asking that more often. Who was the biggest jokester?
What attracted you to this role?
Please do.
Tell me why you got so shredded and...
Ask Martin Lawrence why he got so shredded for Bad Boys. I love that Martin went after himself for that. Will's like, it's been 23 years since the first one. And Martin Lawrence goes, look at me, man. I'm so overweight. This is 23 years.
Is that in the movie?
No, they did it in an interview package before they...
Oh, that's funny.
I just saw that this morning. Because you did... I went and looked at a clip of him from the first Bad Boys movie, and he is real thin.
They're both tiny in that one. They're really like, even Will Smith looks super skinny in that one.
All right, so back to the Nurse Katie 22. Let's see. Kevin would ask the questions about the making of a movie and specific things about the characters, and I was absolutely hooked. I love everyone on the podcast, but I wanted to shout out Kevin because he's the one who got me in the first place. I know literally no one personally who loves cinema like I do, and when you guys nerd out and or get emotional over cinema-related things, I feel that. Everyone in my life has always thought movies are quote-unquote nice, but not something to make a career out of, which is why I'm just now trying to get into it any way I can. I love that you're all friends and that you all identify with each other when it comes to movies because I don't have that, and I can only imagine what that bond must be like. Well, let me tell you, Nurse Katie, sometimes it's exhausting. Sometimes you get 198 text messages because you left your phone in your car while your son was playing a basketball game.
You love it.
Thank you all for everything that you do for your blenders, and don't ever stop. Sincerely, your friendly neighborhood ICU nurse. That's awesome.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
That's a great review. Thank you, Nurse Katie.
That was a great review.
Yeah. Yes. You have.
Sean secretly loves 198 texts coming really, back. You do.
I do.
I'm disappointed.
The OCD in me wanted to get to 200 before I looked at it. And I hope that Katie finds a community in the blenders, because truthfully, the takeaway from our DC meetup was just how amazing our listeners are. And it was really cool to look around the room. And I noticed this at the Chicago one, and I was hoping we would see this in DC, and then it happened, is that we were going around the room trying to talk to as many different people as we could. But when we couldn't get to everybody, everyone else sort of bonded up together.
Yeah.
Like, there were groups from all different cities that just got together and talked. And that's what I think is so special about the people who listen to our show, is that you're coming at it with such a passion, and you come to a meetup like some of these group things that we get to do, and you find people who are like-minded with you. You know, it's like the four of us, essentially, you know, in another form. So hopefully we'll get to do more of those in 2020 and keep the feedback coming. So we're wrapping up for the week. You guys can obviously follow us on social media. I mentioned the Real Blend social media account. You can go to Jake's Takes, Kevin McCarthy TV, or Sean_O'Connell. Drop us a review like Nurse Katie did, and I will read it here on the show. It means an awful lot to you guys as you help us grow this platform out. We will be back next week, where we're going to be talking about probably Bad Boys for Life in more detail. We will play hashtag Matthew McConaughey blend and all the other exciting news coming to, I don't know, I was going to say coming to theaters. No, news doesn't come to theaters. It comes to the show. Let's get out of here. I'm sorry. This is horrible. This is how we end the first show. No. It's not even the first show of 2020.
Sean.
I am way off track.
Sean.
Jake, close this for me. I can't do it.
I can't do it. People flip out if I do it. Okay. 3, 2, 1. Tenet.
Dunkirk.
Can we move on? Jesus, he has another movie coming out.
No. No,
yeah,
we should always be Dunkirk.
For 2020, we should say Tenet. No?
No.
All right, Dunkirk.
Dunkirk is our thing, man.
Until he says it.
All right. If Nolan says it on our show,
yeah,
we'll stop saying it.
Okay.
Do I get to pick the next movie?
Yeah, you do.
Yes.
I'm saying that now.
1917.
And then we got to get the director of that movie to come on and say it. So be realistic.
Psycho.
What if we did like a long one? Like, don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of Harley Quinn.
Longest title, with the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Us.
That's it. Oh, that was fun.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.